You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest tonight is Howard Jones. Howard Jones is an historian and educator and the author of several books, including Mutiny on the Amistad, which Steven Spielberg made into a film. And his latest work is My Lai, Vietnam 1968 and the Descent into Darkness. Howard Jones, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Gary. I appreciate it.
Before I read your book, I had watched the Ken Burns latest film, Vietnam, the 10-part documentary, and it seemed like not very much time was devoted to the events in My Lai. I mean, they covered it, but not too much. I mean, how important is this story to American history?
Well, I think it's crucial to American history. Not too long ago, Thomas Ricks, a military historian, wrote in the New York Times that there are many low points in America's military history, but the absolute lowest point in the 20th century was My Lai. And if you look at what General William Westmoreland said during the war, there were stories coming out about massacres, and so there was a secret internal investigation. And the investigation uncovered at least 300 massacres, and Westmoreland said that of these, the most infamous was My Lai, because never had there been such shooting of civilians, non-combatants, unarmed, 4 to 5 feet away with machine guns, with M16s and everything else you can imagine in broad daylight, and all of this in the course of really 4 hours, the entire episode, but much shorter time in terms of the actual killing. And when you look at the fact that there were over 500 Vietnamese elderly men, women, and children, a number of children, shot unarmed, it just, as Rick said, it marks the lowest point in America's military history. And I think it does us a lot of good to go back and confront something like this rather than keep it hidden. And you might ask, well, why another book on My Lai? Well, every book that I've looked at has an agenda in one form or another. And my purpose in writing this book was to present what I like to call a forensic examination of what happened and to set everything out in a narrative so one can see the cause and effect relationship in such a war as this. And what I don't think was shown adequately, and I agree with you about Kenny Burns' film, it was outstanding, there's no question about that, but I didn't really get the sense that there was such a level of civilian casualties in the course of the war. And My Lai certainly got some attention, but I don't believe it got quite enough attention. And if anything, we should learn from this that this is what happens when you enter a war that in which the fighting takes place among the populace. And more dangerous than anything else, the fact that every Viet Cong was Vietnamese, but not every Vietnamese was Viet Cong. And so it became really difficult for the American soldier to discern in a split second who was the enemy and who was a friend. And it became pretty obvious that if you're 19 years old, which a number of these people were that came in the American platoons in My Lai, if you're that age, or any age, actually, your number one purpose is to survive. And so if you cannot tell the enemy from the friend, the chances are you're going to go in there shooting. And that's really what happened.
Well, do you think there's a reluctance even today to examine this part of history?
Oh, yes. There have been numerous expressions of interest in making this into a movie. But I think people who are involved in it recoil. They back off from the sheer graphic nature of what happened, that you had 105 American soldiers, not all of them committed these murders. There were around 40 who actually did and about 30 that were actually charged, and not one of them was ever convicted. When you consider all of this takes place, it's not a pretty story. Not at all. And you can look for redemptive factors, and I think there were some. I don't think it wipes the slate clean by any means, But there were soldiers who absolutely refused to take part, even to facing off William Calley, the soldier with a 45 and Calley with a rifle, and swearing that he was going to have the soldier court-martialed if he did not obey orders, which were to kill the people in the ditch. They refused to do it, and nothing ever happened to them. And then, of course, you had a number of others who just simply walked away. They were not going to participate. And then, of course, you had the hardcore, those who participated in many ways, including not just shooting and killing, but at least 19 and probably many more rapes were committed, gang rapes, instances of developing what they called double veterans, and you were a double veteran if you raped a female and then killed the person afterward. These things took place by a small number, but they were definitely part of what all happened at this time.
It is pretty ugly, but and there obviously a baby is not going to be the enemy, but there was an argument, I guess, that since little kids could run up to you and throw a grenade in your face or put one in a basket, I don't know how it works, but was there any way that it could have been a legitimate fear of these people?
Well, yeah, there was no question there was fear. I don't want to leave the impression that the Americans were all bad and the Vietnamese were all good or anything of the sort. It was a mixture of many things. Now, Calley was asked about this shooting of children, and his simple answer was they grew up to be Viet Cong. And I don't want a generation 10 years from now coming after me because I didn't shoot someone that was a kid or whatever at the time and was now grown up and in the Viet Cong. I think one also has to understand the frustration that these soldiers felt. First, there were 105 of them, and very few of them had any kind of experience at all in combat. This was their first combat. And so they went in scared. They also went in frustrated. Frustrated and vengeful because in the couple of months earlier, and of course remember that My Lai occurred within the bloodiest year of the entire Vietnam War, which was during the Tet Offensive that began in January of 68 and went on all the way through the year. And so you had a number of Americans who twice had tried to invade My Lai 4, and the villagers surrounded them, used snipers, they used landmines, they used booby traps, and all kinds of things, and the result was they barely got out alive. And then the result of this was that around 28 of these young men in these three platoons were killed on the eve of going into My Lai 4, and killed in some of the most hideous ways. And I don't know how many had heard about what was going on at basically the same time, the Battle of Hue, with all the viciousness and so forth. And then William Calley, who himself had witnessed a number of atrocities that were killed, and of course committed them himself. So you had a number of these people who were scared, vengeful, angry. They had been killed by an enemy they had not yet even seen. How do you shoot a landmine? How do you shoot a sniper? What do you do about a booby trap? Obviously, you cannot do anything except be careful. And then if you look at the villagers, they're not telling you where these landmines are. And so they, of course, automatically became the enemy. And everyone wore black pajama outfits. It didn't matter whether you were Viet Cong or you were a Viet Cong sympathizer or you were just simply caught in the middle and didn't want anything to do with the invader. And, of course, the U.S. was the invader. And so these villagers tended to come together over the outside threat.
Now, Lieutenant Calley was the one who was charged with the crime. Was he the instigator of this event?
He believed, and I think this is true, he honestly believed he was following orders. And no one really disagreed with him following orders, except that two things. One, he should have had, this was what the military said, he should have had the common sense to realize that shooting an unarmed civilian, man, woman, or child, is wrong, absolutely wrong. You don't do that. And the other, that he had witnessed some atrocities, as I said. There was one case in which he visited a villager he knew real well, and the villager was all distraught, and Callie asked him why, and he said, "Do you see that jar, that liquid over there with bloody matter in it," and so forth. His son had just been captured by the Viet Cong, and they killed him. And then there was another instance that was quite infamous among the Americans, a story that a squad had gone out at night on an ambush, and when they came back, some of them did not return with them. One of them was missing, and they found him the next day, skinned alive. He had been screaming all night long, and no one could do anything about it. And so you had all of this vengeful hatred that was building up, and again, against an invisible enemy. How frustrating that must have been.
So do you think it's because of the nature of the person who was Lieutenant Callie and all of these things coming together that made this happen, or would have this happened if Callie hadn't been there?
I think what you said is absolutely correct. It's like the movie The Perfect Storm. Everything seemed to come together at the same time. You had inexperienced young soldiers for the first time carrying a weapon, or maybe not the first time, but the first time certainly into battle. And Philip Caputo once mentioned that an Australian told him in the course of the Vietnam War that there is nothing more dangerous than a 19-year-old with a gun, and then authorizing him to shoot. And so you had that problem. And then you had this land, this Indian country, where they were fighting among the worst kinds of environmental problems you can imagine, the heat, the weather, the snakes, the every insect that you could ever imagine, everything else crawling around them, fighting against an enemy they did not see that was behind the banana grass or something like that, and hidden in the villages. And then you were to invade the village. The plan was that really a three-pronged invasion, that one platoon, of course, the whole company, Charlie Company, was under Ernest Medina, who incidentally denied ever giving the orders to waste the Vietnamese that you find. And Callie said, "Yes, you did." And in court, the court martial just finally said, "There's no way we could ever prove or disprove who was telling the truth about this." So that remained an open question. But getting back to the actual plan, if you can visualize a My Lai village that's rectangular in shape, the three platoons under Charlie Company were to meet at the southwest corner of My Lai 4. And the first and second platoons, one of which was led by Callie, Callie was to take his men, about 25 or so, and go into the village and cut right, go east. And then the second platoon was to go up to the northwest corner, and then both of them were to go through and sweep the village clean. And the number one objective was do it quickly. Number two was don't let any Vietnamese get behind you. In other words, keep them in front of you. But remember, you're not going to find many Vietnamese villagers because they've all been told to get out of town, to go to the market and whatever. That order never went out, but they were under the impression that orders had been sent. And American intelligence had said that don't worry about the villagers, they will be out of the way. And the only people you're going to meet will be either Viet Cong or Viet Cong sympathizers. So you're going to be free to shoot anyone who poses any kind of danger to you. In other words, if they run, you warn them to stop. If they don't stop, you shoot a warning shot. And if you don't stop them then you shoot to kill. And what is any villager going to do if his village is being invaded by helicopters overhead and soldiers on the ground, especially since this hadn't happened before? Mm-hmm. This had simply not happened.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We return now to our conversation with historian Howard Jones, author of My Lai, Vietnam, 1968, and The Descent into Darkness.
When the operation was over, did the men return to their base and think, oh man, we did a terrible, horrible thing? Or did they think, all right, we were successful, we defeated the enemy? What were their thoughts afterwards?
The best I can tell, many of them were interviewed, of course, and there are many interviews available by many sources. They knew that something had happened, but they didn't have, not that many had a grasp of the magnitude of what happened. And that just sounds like it's ridiculous. It's a little village. How could you not know what all was going on? Well, the fact of the matter is that the soldiers came in and they were stay together and make two big sweeps. And then after about 45 minutes, the third platoon would come in and would mop up and they would sweep the village clean. But the problem is you couldn't see more than 3 or 4 feet in front of you because of all the vegetation and the crookedness of the paths that went through and so forth. And so you had maybe one or two soldiers that had any kind of real grasp about what all was going on. In other words, I might not have seen anything. You might have seen two people killed. This person over here might have seen a gang rape. This one might not have seen anything either. And so when they came back, each one of them had a story to tell, but many times there wasn't much to the story. And when they were questioned about it, the first thing they did was to shut up. No, we didn't hear anything. We didn't know anything. And I think what it came down to was a rather informal type of conspiracy of silence. There wasn't an organized attempt to do it, but I think each person looked at it, now, wait a minute, if I say something, my buddies are going to kill me. Who's going to believe me? I know I'm supposed to report to the higher-ups immediately when I see a war crime being taking place right in front of me. But the problem with that is that these were not, technically speaking, war crimes, because they were not Viet Cong, at least not officially. They could not be easily classified as the enemy. We were actually killing South Vietnamese. And so the war crimes idea is questionable about whether that could be applied.
It would just be a regular crime, is what you're saying?
It would be a crime. It certainly could be murder. But then, of course, you've got to have witnesses who will attest to what happened. For example, when it came to the 19 rapes in which charges were brought by the Criminal Investigation Division of the Army after the war, or after My Lai, none of the people there who witnessed some of the rapes could technically say they saw a rape, because the letter of the law says you must witness penetration. And if you don't witness that, your testimony is not worth anything. And then, of course, there was the other part of it. There was one soldier who, a guy named Dennis Bunning from California, who William Pierce, the investigator of what happened at My Lai, called one of the real heroes of all of this. Bunning tried to stop the rapes. He was a big guy. And he told one or two guys, stop it. That's the end of it. And the next thing he knew, five or six bigger guys all came and got him and held a gun to his head and told him if he said one more thing, he was going to be left out in the Indian country somewhere, and that would be the end of you. So he shut up, and others did the same thing. And then, of course, who are you going to report to? You report to your higher-up. Well, what about Cali? He's participating in the killing. What about Medina? He is also guilty of a number of crimes, that you could say. And beyond that, where do you go? And who's going to believe you if you are a private and you wander into an officer's office someday afterward and all by yourself claim that a war crime was committed? And in fact, when three of the pilots, two of them in particular, did appear and testify, the officials there turned on them and tried to undermine their argument.
Well, eventually the news of this event came to light. I mean, it happened in 1968, but I don't think we heard about it until 1969, right?
Right, November. Yeah, you had a young soldier who had a big mouth. A guy named Charles Groover was in one of the platoons. And he saw a friend of his, a later journalist, Ronald Ridenour, talk with him at a bar. They were having a few beers. And Groover said, "Hey, you know what our guys did? We just wiped out a village. We killed every single one of them." And Ridenour was, "What?" And he started going through what happened. And Ridenour didn't know about this. But he ended up talking to some of his friends he knew had been at My Lai 4, and it became obvious this story was true. So here he was sitting on this story, and if he didn't expose it, he'd be part of it. If he did expose it, he's liable to be killed. So he waited till he got out of the army, and then later on he sent 5 registered letters to Richard Nixon, to various other dignitaries, congressmen, and so forth, about 30 of them, appealing for a congressional investigation based on what he had seen and heard talking to the various people who were there. And, of course, that didn't go a long way and was poo-pooed right away. And then the pressure built so much that finally the Army ordered an internal investigation. So the Inspector General's office launched an investigation interviewing those who were there, followed by CID investigating every soldier they could find who was there. And the IG officer in charge of that said at one point, "I prayed to God this was fiction that people were saying. I just don't believe that this could have happened." And then finally he interviewed this young guy named Paul Medlow. And Paul Medlow from New Goshen, Indiana, confessed to doing a lot of the killing and charged Callie with doing the killing, so much of it, and was so graphically clear that Colonel Wilson, believed him. And then there was another investigation by CID, and that man came across Ron Haberle, who was the Army photographer, and he just happened to slip out the words that he had photos. And I go, "What? Yes, I've got photos. You want to see them?" He brought them in the next day, and there was the evidence. Now, the Army tried its best to cover this up. After the battle, a young guy named Jay Roberts, who was the Army press person, and then Ron Haberle, the photographer, were going to see a lot of what happened. And Haberle and Roberts didn't know what to do with it. Do I write a story telling the truth or what? So they went to Lieutenant Colonel Frank Barker, the one who was over Medina and the others and who had concocted the plan of invasion, and they asked him about this, and he said, "There was nothing like that. You go on and write this story." And he told them the story to write. And if you read the newspapers and the Stars and Stripes, New York Times, and whatever, this was a fantastic battle victory for the American forces, wiping out a Viet Cong hotspot. And here is the irony of it all. Even though the American intelligence said that there would be, you could expect maybe up to 400 crack Viet Cong on the spot when you invade, which meant that they would outnumber the Americans about 2-1 at least, which was another very scary proposition for them. It was all wrong, absolutely wrong. The commander in charge, I read an interview with him years afterward, and he claimed that we were 3 miles away, rehabbing in the mountains from the Tet Offensive. We were not there. They simply were not there. There was no enemy there. We were shooting civilians, and that was it.
And these civilians were South Vietnamese, the country that we were allegedly defending.
Yes.
Well, do you think then, Dr. Jones, that there are other places in which this might have happened that there's no Groover to tell us about, that there were other My Lais?
Well, the Army itself in this secret internal investigation uncovered at least 300 other massacres. And I don't know that they were on the scale of what happened at My Lai or the personal level of what happened at My Lai, the atrocity level of what happened at My Lai, but there were certainly unjust killings, according to the army itself.
Really nothing happened to anybody involved. I mean, even Lieutenant Calley, right?
The only person who was convicted was William Calley. And Aubrey Daniel, who was a very, very sharp captain as prosecutor, built such a convincing case. He spun a story that brought in witnesses, a large number of them, and they all said he was there. We saw him do this. Half dozen of them attested that they saw him pull the trigger and shoot him. And then Calley himself admitted that he shot into the ditch from 4 to 5 feet, shooting men, women, and children in the ditch. So he admitted to guilt. They charged him with over 100, I think it was 109 murders. But Daniel said, all I need to do is get at least one count of murder, and we've got him. And they did end up getting 22 counts of murder. And he was convicted. He was sentenced to life imprisonment, hard labor, forfeited everything he had in the army, all of these things. And then at that point, President Nixon became involved. Nixon saw political hay to be made of this. He claimed that he thought Calley was a good soldier, that he was being convicted of a bum rap, that all of this is the result of a war brought about by what Nixon called in this context the dirty, rotten Jews of New York, and that it was a leftist conspiracy, all this kind of thing. Let's investigate. He called a committee together. They set up a My Lai tactical force. Let's investigate Ron Ridenour. What kind of guy is he? Let's investigate the pilots, Hugh Thompson in particular, Larry Colburn. What kind of people are they? What's Haberle? How much money is he making on these pictures and so forth? Tail them. I want John Ehrlichman to put a tail on all of them, and let's see what we can find. And it was a dirty tricks campaign that was set up by Nixon. Nixon told his people shortly after he got word, he was out in California, San Clemente at the time, told his people around him at the Nixon White House there that, you know, of course, that I'm going to commute his sentence. No matter what it is, I will commute him. But I've got to wait a while. I've got to make it look like I'm studying it very carefully and so forth. And then eventually, I'm going to end up pardoning him. Well, they didn't pardon him because he was already gone from office by the time Calley went free. So Calley, because of Nixon, did not spend any time in the prison at Fort Benning. He instead had a house arrest at the one in Kansas. It slips my mind right now. But anyway, he was going to spend prison at Leavenworth. He was going to spend time in prison there, and Nixon stopped that and put him in house arrest at Fort Benning, Georgia. There his girlfriends came and went. He spent 3.5 years in house arrest, and then finally the first appeal reduced his sentence to 20 years. Another appeal reduced it to 10. And when it reached 10, the time he had spent in jail, so to speak, already, made him eligible for parole. So he was paroled in November of 74 and is today scot-free.
Did you make an attempt to contact him when you were writing your book?
Oh, yes. I had a student at the University of Alabama where I taught, and he knew a newspaper man in Columbus, Georgia, who was a childhood, longtime friend of William Calley. He's a newsman, news anchor. And he said, why don't you call him and see if he will set up something with Calley? Well, I called him and I talked with him, Al Fleming. And Fleming said, yes, I'm a close friend of his. I will try to get him to talk with you, but I don't think he will do it. And he wouldn't. And that was early in my research. And then about 5 years into my research, as I was getting where I began to see the end of the book coming, although I didn't know there'd still be another 4 years onto it, but I tried again. And he said he won't talk with you. And Medina won't talk to anybody. He's in a nursing home, I believe, up in Michigan. that he won't talk to anybody either. See, he lied in court, too. Callie told the truth, which convicted him, really, and then nothing happened, really, to him. Medina lied on two counts. First, William Eckhart, the main My Lai prosecutor in the Army, who I did interview, he's out at Kansas City Law School, Eckhart said that they wanted to bring murder charges against Medina, but realized very quickly that would not fly. He would not be able to get enough witnesses, credible witnesses, because you couldn't subpoena them. Because the way the law worked at the time, there were 30 American soldiers who were charged with crimes. And when they tried to bring charges against them, 15 of them had already mustered out of the Army. And a Supreme Court decision in the mid-1950s had ruled that a soldier in uniform could not be tried in a civilian court for a crime. And the other side of it is a soldier who is now an ex-serviceman and is a civilian cannot be tried for a crime committed while he wore the uniform.
Wow.
And so once they corrected that in 1996 with the War Powers Act. But once you get out of the Army, you're free. And Callie was going to muster out like September 6th, I believe it was, and they rushed through all of the paperwork and everything in order to stop that and charge him the day before. They made it by one day, otherwise he would have gone free and nothing would have happened. So you have these soldiers who don't have to appear. Eckhart said we had no subpoena power. We had to rely on their goodwill. Some came in. A couple of them said they saw Medina shoot people, that they saw him walk among the dead and all of this. And he claimed he didn't see any dead. He didn't see piles of bodies. One soldier said that I saw him step over a child. And when he came to a pile of bodies, I saw him look to the left rather than look at them. So he could honestly say, I never saw them. And so he claimed he never saw them, and you could not prove it. Because F. Lee Bailey, who was the defense attorney for Ernest Medina, was so good, so talented, that he undercut the credibility of anyone who came up there and said something against Medina. And so he could not be proved to have killed anyone. So Eckhart dropped that charge and then tried to get him on the charge of witnessing a mass murder and then doing nothing about it. But he could never get it to where the point to say that I have proof that he witnessed the murder. How do you know what he saw? And then the other thing he tried to get him on was withholding information, not passing it off. When the trial, he was exonerated. Then when the statute of limitations on crimes, not war crimes there is no statute of limitations, but when the statute on crimes ran out 2 years after My Lai, there was another trial of Medina's Colonel Orrin Henderson, who was in charge of everything around the Maricao Division, except, of course, the very top where the general sat. He was charged for withholding information, and he kept claiming, I didn't have any information. And Medina appeared in trial and said, I didn't give him any information. I kept it from him. And he admitted later in a lie detector test, which was not admissible in court, of course, he admitted later in a lie detector test that 45 minutes into the battle, he had seen masses of bodies on the trail outside of right at the corner of My Lai Village, and turned away from them, would not admit to seeing any. And the probability is that because of that, 250 or more Vietnamese lost their lives. That would have stopped the battle right at that point. The whole story, as you said earlier, is an ugly story.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with historian Howard Jones. His new book is called My Lai, Vietnam, 1968, and the Descent into Darkness. Howard Jones, earlier in our conversation, you quoted President Richard Nixon making anti-Semitic remarks. Were you quoting from the infamous Nixon White House tapes?
Yes, on the tapes, both at the University of Virginia, the Miller Center, and then tapes at the Nixon Library, which is an excellent place to work, believe me.
Well, when President Nixon wanted to commute Cowley's sentence or whatever it was he did, weren't there hundreds of soldiers or more that were in prison for one offense or another that said, hey, what about me?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Many people brought that up, that there were some on death row or there for long extended periods of time who had done much less. But the president had earmarked this person. He was going to take a stand on him because it was, I'm sorry, just politically profitable to do that. If you look at the newspapers, and I looked at the newspapers very carefully and letters that came in to the Nixon administration members, the letters were like 100-1 in favor of releasing Cowley, that he was not a baby killer, that he was a soldier who just did his duty and killed the enemy. And they were convinced it was a leftist conspiracy. It was an anti-war kind of thing, a Eugene McCarthy-like type of thing, or George
McGovern.
George McGovern. Just slipped my mind as I was trying to think one more step ahead. But George McGovern and Jane Fonda kind of thing. All of that came together. And Nixon was playing that game. There's no question about that. Blame it on the leftists. And this is, if you look at the newspapers, this is what they said. This is wrong. That's what's happening to Cowley. And what's really ironic about this is that you have a strange situation in which Cowley brought together the hawks and the doves. Not on purpose, obviously, but he brought them together. He caused the hawks to believe that the U.S. should get out of Vietnam because the military, the politicians, and others won't let Cowley and people like him win the war. And so let's get out. And then on the other side, you had the anti-war people who were arguing the war is unwinnable. Cowley is an example of what kind of war this is and what it brings out in human beings. And so therefore, we need to stop this war. Let's get out of Vietnam. So it brought them together on this.
Well, that's what Nixon said. I want to bring them together. That was his. I remember him saying that one.
It's really a story.
One of the most, you got some photos in your book, and some of them are just incredibly horrible to look at. But one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen is this Esquire magazine cover with.
I knew when you said that. This, I think, is a perfect example of the banality of evil. And I read a story about the photographer who brought this all together for Esquire magazine. He met a lot of resistance when he said, let's have William Cowley sitting among a small group of Vietnamese children laughing and playing with them. And some were appalled by that idea that, my God, you're going to show him as being loving and compassionate toward people he had slaughtered. And the guy said, it's not going to be read that way by a lot of people. And that is that what you're going to see is the jackal. You're going to see evil in the form of a banal person, an innocent person. And I remember Roger Spiller, an American military historian who was at Fort Leavenworth and held the George Marshall chair, the first civilian to do that. And he said, in all his years of teaching military history, the most frightening thing he ever saw was that many of the killings take place by people who are ordinary people. You don't know what's going to happen to them when they get into a certain context. And we could not have predicted that Cowley would have been that kind of a person, or really many of the others. But they got into this context, and something happened to them. They're ordinary people. And according to Spiller, he said that we're all one step away from another My Lai. We've got to find people who are officers who have ethics, We've got to, and you can see what happened. The Naval Academy, the various other service academies set up combat ethic courses, teaching the potential officers that there is such a thing as an ethical code. William Eckhart said one of the biggest reforms, and it sounds unbelievable to say this, but one of the biggest reforms we made in the Army was to add a provision telling soldiers you do not kill unarmed civilians. That had to be written so that it was clear. And the Army took the writing of the medal, soldier's medal that was given to Thompson in 1998, took the inscription off, put it in a box quote, and inserted in the Army field manual. And Thompson and Colburn, many times in the late 1990s and early 2000, went on teaching trips, teaching missions, really, to the service academies, explaining what happened at My Lai. And they're on YouTube. You could find those. They're really fascinating to read these. They tried to teach what they had learned in Vietnam. And then, of course, you had a guy like Tim O'Brien, who's a famous novelist, but he was at My Lai 4 after all of this had happened. And he was asked, well, how did this happen? And he said, you know, we did many of the same things they did in one form or another. We killed people that turned out to be innocent, but never anything like this. He said, we never went out and wiped out a village. Well, why did they do this? And he said something about, well, people under certain conditions become savages. Some of them are victims of what he called the fog of war, that you get out into a situation like this and you cannot any longer tell the difference between what is good and what is wrong, what's bad, that you lose all sense of any kind of civilized existence. You go back to the very native environment that people were in from the very beginning of time. And so you just kill many people. Well, why do they do this? And he says, I don't know. I just don't know.
Do you think the image of the GI was forever changed because of this event?
I think they were tarnished, but I think the Army has made every effort to change this. When the Army went into Desert Storm, the commanding officer told the men right before they went in, he said, no more My Lais. That's not going to happen anymore. And I think that kind of attitude has helped, that they've inserted in the field manual all the things that Thompson did, and they've been very clear about what happened at My Lai, all this kind of thing. And they've tried to raise the character. And this is the bottom line. This is what Philip Caputo called the bottom line, that he believed that Cali was so different from so many others of his time, and that he never had a net to catch him in terms of character. For some reason, he lacked that. And so many have said that Cali should not have been an officer, and he should not have even been in the Army. But because there were so many being killed in this kind of war of attrition that worked both ways, that he managed to be the bottom of the list, graduating from high school, flunked out of junior college, came in on the bottom list of OCS school, and the next thing you know, he's in charge of a platoon.
We've been talking with historian Howard Jones. He's the author of many books, and this one, a book he spent many years researching and writing, is an important document of one of the darkest episodes in American military history. The book is called My Lai, Vietnam 1968, and the Descent into Darkness. Howard Jones, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thank you so much for having me on your program. I appreciate it very much.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com or check us out here at ksco.com. Your comments are always welcome. I want to thank my guest, Professor Howard Jones. His book is called My Lai, Vietnam, 1968, and The Descent into Darkness. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.